So, just in case any of you have forgotten, we're exploring the mind and its functions. And again, just in case any of you have forgotten, we started off by dealing with those Chaitadharmas, those 10 Chaitadharmas that are concerned with the way in which the mind works predominantly. And then we went on to look at the 4 undetermined mental events, in other words, those that can be skillful or unskillful or merely neutral. And then we've been looking at the 37, I think, at a quick guess, mental events that are ethically determined, in other words, that are definitely either skillful or unskillful. So far, our exploration of the ethically determined Chaitadharmas, mental events, has formed a pattern each day. At least it has in my mind. I hope it has in yours. So, for instance, we looked at the pattern formed by the... I'll talk about them in terms of the skillful states. By Shraddha, Kri, and Apatrapya, which are sort of fundamental primary factors in spiritual life. In terms of our attempt to live spiritual life, these are, in a sense, primary. Then we looked at Alobha and Advesha, non-craving and non-hatred, which are the counteracting of the basic negative forces. And then yesterday we looked at Amoha, and all the complex of kleshas that oppose Amoha. So in that pattern, we were looking at the most fundamental issue of spiritual life, what spiritual life is really about, which is moving from avidya to Amoha. The next 2 days, today and tomorrow, we're going to be dealing with somewhat more miscellaneous collections of Chaitadharmas. There probably is some sort of pattern, but I haven't seen it. They are, of course, connected because all the Chaitadharmas, Kushala Chaitadharmas and Kleshas are very intimately connected. They sort of merge one into the other. Some of them are not that distinct. And in fact, in some of the Abhidharma accounts, Kushala Chaitadharmas that we're going to deal with are not even considered really separate mental events. They're more assemblages of other mental events. But I'm not going to go into that in exposition. So today we're going to deal with the 3 complexes. We're going to deal with virya koshidya, that is energy or vigour, and laziness. Then we're going to deal with prashabdi and sthyana. Prashabdi being tranquility, serenity, something of that kind. Sthyana, dullness, rigidity, even depression. Then finally, upeksha, audacia, and vikshepa. Upeksha being generally translated as equanimity, audacia as restlessness, and vikshepa as distraction. So there are 3 complexes which are interrelated, but not in the same obvious way as the ones we've been dealing with up till now. Let's start with virya, which is a very, very important, fundamental issue in spiritual life. It's usually translated as energy, as vigour, or as diligence, sometimes even as enthusiasm. And none of this is really right. It's not possible to translate virya, in my opinion, with one single English word. And it requires, even when you found a little phrase, it requires some explanation to get at what it really means. So what is it? Well, it's what connects faith with effective practice. You've got faith, but something has to activate that faith and put it into effect. So you've got Shraddha, you're attracted to the 3 jewels. You're attracted to the skillful, you're attracted to positive mental events, to skillful mental events. But you have to actually take the step of translating your attraction into action, into movement. So virya is turning your mind to wholesome things. Let's say that, for instance, you're doing meditation, your mind is drifting into, well, kamachanda. You're drifting into sensuous longings of various kinds, and we all know what that means. So you become aware of what you're doing, and you have a renewed feeling of aspiration. And so then you turn your mind from the unskillful, the klesha-driven or contaminated objects, to a skillful object. You come back to the metta bhavana, for instance. So it's the action of turning your mind from the unskillful or from the less skillful to the skillful or the more skillful. That is virya. It's experienced moment by moment as you deliberately move your energies in the direction of something that is skillful or even more skillful. It's that constant effort to move in the direction that your faith is attracted to. That is virya in sum. Bhante translates it as energy in pursuit of the good, which is it's pretty good. That's getting quite close to it. But I think one has to even wonder whether the word energy is a good one, because energy is such a general term. You know, it's E equals MC squared and so on. It's a quite neutral term for energy in general. Everything is energy in the end. But here we're dealing with specifically the mental force that chooses the skillful or even the more skillful. It's definitely not energy in general. Sometimes, it's not so common, but sometimes in the movement you used to get almost a sort of cult of energy. You know, people would say, well, you know, loud music, that's virya. You know, a fast train, that's virya. Well, it isn't. In fact, energy of the general kind is often a form of laziness. So that brings us on then to the opposite to virya, which is koshidya, which means pretty straightforwardly laziness, but very specifically laziness in the sense of either letting your mind turn from the skillful to the less skillful, or allowing your mind to continue in the unskillful. And what's interesting is that laziness isn't merely an absence of effort. It's a countervailing effort. You actually choose the less skillful. You choose to allow yourself to continue with the unskillful. So, yes, koshidya is not merely avirya. It's not just lack of virya. It's a kind of virya in its own right. Energy does go into the unskillful. It's turning away from the wholesome and attending to the unwholesome. There are said to be three kinds of koshidya. This is one of my favourite teachings from this collection of teachings, which I've been over many, many times, but I think there's some really useful insights in it. The first kind of koshidya, of laziness, is the most obvious kind. It's said to be indulging in the pleasures of lying down and not getting up. It's pretty straightforward. You're lying there in your bed. You know it's time to get up for prostrations. You hear people next door moving around, but you just think, oh, this is so nice. And you just stay there. That, in a way, is the most healthy form of koshidya. At least it has some sort of pleasure connected with it. You know, it's sort of mildly endearing. Although, of course, it gradually runs down your energies, so that you're less and less able to get up for prostrations, even for meditation, even for breakfast. So that's the first form. It's indulging in the pleasures of lying down and not getting up. The second form is the form of laziness that consists in allowing yourself to be carried along by unskillful motivations. Yes, you've got some feeling for the ideal, you've got some feeling for virtue, you've even got some grasp of positive mental states, but negative ones come along, unwholesome ones come along, unskillful ones come along, and you just take the path of least resistance. It's much easier often to go along with lobha and dvesha than it is to turn to alobha and advesha. They require less effort on your part to just give in to them. So this is the laziness of giving in to unskillful motivations. And of course, this kind of laziness can be extremely active. And this is why we must be careful not to think of virya simply in terms of energy. Because some people who are, from this point of view, extremely lazy, are actually very vigorous. They're very busy fulfilling their unskillful motivations. You remember that Gampopa famously defines laziness as making friends and influencing people. No, what is it? Gaining power and reputation, something like that.
Making money and subduing enemies.
I think it's Thersites in Troilus and Cressida. War and lechery. It's all war and lechery. So, you know, war and lechery can be extremely vigorous, but they are laziness. You're going along with the basic instincts which have become unskillful. The third form of laziness is to me the most interesting and revelatory. It's the laziness that consists in self-pity. It's the laziness that comes from despair. It's the laziness that says, who am I to do that? I can't do that. Yes, I believe in the ideal, but a person like me, with all the experiences I've had in my life, with my particular character, my particular disadvantages, what can I do? It's victim mentality, where you allow yourself an indulgence because you consider yourself to be irresponsible, morally or non-responsible, let's say, because you are the victim. Because this has been done to you, therefore you cannot make a spiritual effort. And I find this very, very useful because I think that sometimes the problem with this form of laziness is it's self-justifying. You just think to yourself, well, what's the point? I can't really do anything because look at me. You know, I've not had these advantages. This has been done to me. What can I do? So you let yourself off the hook and you don't even notice that's what you're doing because you've let yourself off the hook, if you see what I mean. Because you've abnegated moral responsibility, you don't even apply a moral judgment to your abnegation of moral responsibility, if you see what I mean. So you're in deep trouble. Quickly rescuing yourself at the last minute. Yes, I think this is the most pertinent of the analyses of Kaushidya, the laziness that consists in despair, or self-pity, where you just give up, even though you appear to still be idealistic. You still appear to honour the ideal. So it's, if you like, it's the third, lack of the third form of Shraddha. It's lack of the longing faith, belief in capacities, in your capacity to develop. You let yourself off by analysing your own position as one of a victim. Nothing can be done. So interesting is Kaushidya that I've collected from somewhere else another threefold analysis of laziness. I think that laziness is so common and so fundamental to our experience that it's quite important we get it nailed, at least in analysis. Because after all, if you're not exercising virya, then you're exercising Kaushidya. It's one or the other. I'm sorry. There are three forms in this second analysis. The first form of laziness is where you regard spiritual practice as unnecessary. So it really is ashradhya with a vengeance. You just think, I don't need that. That's not to do with me. There's no spiritual ideal. So that's a form of laziness. You do not take the effort to clarify and identify and live by your own intuitions of a higher life. You see spiritual practice as unnecessary. You turn your back on it. The second form is the procrastinating laziness. Here you do see that a spiritual life is possible and necessary, and even you want to live it, but not now. Tomorrow, there will be a time for such a thing. So you put it off. And of course, this is one of the great weaknesses of Buddhism, traditionally, because it teaches the doctrine of rebirth. You think that, well, this life, I'll just, you know, do enough to get a decent rebirth, and then I'll make a spiritual effort. And it does seem, when one looks at Buddhist history, as if this is quite a common weakness. I think Bhante said that the besetting sin of Buddhism is laziness. And that would be my observation too, that we're reasonably tolerant, we're not fanatical on the whole. Yes, you do get Buddhist fanatics and people who are intolerant, but on the whole, the weakness of Buddhism is not really making enough effort, not being sufficiently strongly motivated. So the procrastinating laziness is the one that puts it off. The third form of laziness is the destructive laziness. Here, again, you acknowledge spiritual efforts to be necessary, but you find unwholesome motivations much more attractive. So you give in to them and follow them. And that is a fairly basic problem that we have. You're sitting to do meditation, you really want to concentrate your mind, but you don't have Dhammachanda at that point. You don't have chanda for the object of meditation. But your interest flows elsewhere, and you sit daydreaming, fantasizing, and so forth. So these are the second three forms of laziness. There's the laziness that just sees spiritual life as unnecessary, procrastinating, that sees it as necessary but not now, and the destructive laziness that sees it as necessary but finds the unwholesome much more attractive. So I think it's quite good to identify fairly thoroughly one's own habits of laziness and to acknowledge as laziness what is laziness, if you see what I mean. And I think this is particularly true of the laziness of self-pity and the procrastinating laziness. And often also, of course, energetic pursuit of unskillful things. We need to acknowledge that actually we're being spiritually lazy and not exerting ourselves in a positive direction. Because once you've acknowledged that it's laziness that possesses you, well, you're already halfway to virya. It's quite easy then to make the shift to virya. So one should at least have enough virya to acknowledge that one's lazy. Virya itself is analysed in terms of various lists. So I'll give you a few of those to illustrate more clearly what we mean by virya. The most well-known is the fivefold classification of virya. First of all, there's what's called the virya that arrays oneself in armour. So you put on armour. So what is armour? Armour is what protects you. So this is the virya that defends you against your own unskillful patterns and habits. So you have enough virya to stop yourself from drifting into unskillful behaviour and to keep up your vigilance against unskillful thoughts. Of course, here it becomes quite like apramada. But this is the first form of virya, the arraying oneself in armour, defending oneself against the unskillful. The second form is the virya that consists in applied effort. This is probably the form of virya that we're most familiar with, which is systematically giving your effort to developing skillful things, applying a practice, carrying out various spiritual exercises. In every situation you find yourself, trying to raise your mind up to a somewhat higher level. You remember I quoted earlier on Bhante saying that he thought that most of us put up with far too dull and low a state of consciousness, and that with a very little effort we could raise our minds up and be in a generally positive state most of the time. I think it was at the time he was talking of this, he was talking about the possibility of living in what he called a dilute dhyanic state, so that you were all the time
mildly dhyanic. You weren't so dhyanic that you bumped into lampposts and things like that, but you were sufficiently concentrated and uplifted to be able to carry out all the normal functions of life in that sort of state. And presumably when you didn't need to be doing anything, well, you just rise into dhyana. So Bhante seemed to think that this was a normal state. He described it as the happy, healthy human state, which most of us achieve from time to time. But applied effort in the first place would be to just remaining in that sort of generally positive and happy state most of the time, let alone anything further. But especially it would mean applying oneself to spiritual practice. The third form of virya is the virya that does not despair. And this is very closely related, of course, to the virya that consists in, the koshidya that consists in self-pity. So with virya, you think, well, yes, I may have disadvantages. I may be the most gifted chap or whatever it is, but still I can make an effort. You don't sort of become daunted, especially in the Mahayana context. You don't become daunted by the extraordinary magnitude of the ideal. You don't catch a glimpse of shunyata and just think, well, that's just too much, I can't do that. You don't catch a glimpse of what the bodhisattva really is and think, well, I could never even approach that. You're able to encompass the ideal and at the same time recognize that you can move towards it. So it's very much the third form of shraddha, the longing shraddha. The fourth form of virya is the virya that does not turn back. So in the course of your spiritual life, in the course of your ordinary human life, with a spiritual motivation, you're bound to come up against difficulties. Life is difficult. Zindagi mushkil hai. All the time, difficulties are coming to us. We're finding that people are opposing us, people are unfair to us, people don't understand, all sorts of problems come. And it's too easy for us then to think, well, spiritual life is too difficult for us. We join the spiritual community on the assumption that everything is going to be wonderful. And we assume that everybody in the spiritual community was going to be very loving and kind to us and understand us all the time. If you haven't learnt by now that that's not always the case, you've got a shock coming to you. Even in the spiritual community, there's conflict, there's misunderstanding, and so on. So one has to have the fortitude to keep going when difficulties arise. One's faith should not be a naive faith, which just expects everything to be going your way. One has to have the courage and the fortitude to keep going under difficulties. I think this is an area where probably many of us need to do much more work. I think our times are softening times. I think that the nature of a consumer society is increasingly to make us think that we are owed happiness, we're owed good fortune, that we're owed no difficulties. So we're less and less capable of enduring. I heard recently that a major European nation, which I won't mention, had been unable to find adequate recruits for its army. In fact, it was abolishing the conscription because they found that the great majority of recruits were completely unsuited to army life. They couldn't sleep in a tent. They couldn't, hold a rifle up for too long, and so on. And I think this is what's going on. We're becoming soft. Now, I'm not suggesting that spiritual life is in the army. I know I have to be careful of this. It's one of the myths about Subhuti, but there we are. But nonetheless, you do have to go through difficulties. And what we tend to feel is, if there are difficulties, it's somebody's fault. Somebody should remove them. The public preceptors, your Kalyana Mitras, the chairman, whoever it is, should take those difficulties away. And it is quite interesting. In India, people have much greater capacity to endure. And they will put up with hardship, just in the material sense, without even thinking about it. Here, we're getting softer and softer at that level, at least. And I think it goes much deeper than that. So we need to make sure we've got the virya that does not turn back when the going gets tough. I won't complete the... Finally, we need the virya that is never satisfied. Because the danger is that you make an effort and you achieve something and then you think, there we are, we've done that. Retirement, spiritual retirement. You need to make sure that, well, in Bhante's phrase, the good is not the enemy of the best, and that you're constantly reaching for new goals, new heights, you could say. You're never satisfied. Yes, you achieve something, you achieve a level of understanding, but you realise that there's more to understand. You achieve a certain depth of concentration, but you realise you've got to go further. So you never just settle down in spiritual life. This is the fifth kind of virya. We can also see virya, of course, in terms of the four right efforts. And these are really an analysis of virya in a very immediate sense. There's the effort to eradicate those unskillful mental states that already possess our minds. There's the effort to prevent the arising of unskillful mental states that haven't arisen. That's the armor-like virya. The effort to cultivate skillful states that have not arisen. That's applied effort. And the maintenance of those skillful states that have already arisen. So minute by minute, we need to be cultivating skillful states and eradicating unskillful states. I'll give you one more list because it ties up with something that I've been looking at and investigating with others quite a bit. There's another categorization of effort in terms of three levels. First of all, the effort to restrain yourself, the effort that consists in self-restraint. In other words, restraining yourself from unskillful things. And this, of course, is the same as the Sangvara Shila, for those of you who've been studying Asanga's chapter on ethics from the Bodhisattva Bhumi. Then there's the effort to cultivate positive states. And this this corresponds to Guna Parigraha Shila in Asanga's Bodhisattva Bhumi. And then finally, there's the effort that consists in benefiting other beings, which is the equivalent of the Asattva Artha Kriya Shila in Asanga's text. So these three levels, which constitute the essence of effort, prevention of the arising of unskillful things, cultivation of skillful things, and helping other beings. So this puts effort in the Bodhisattva context, virya in the Bodhisattva context. So, virya, we've explored fairly fully. It's a very, very important and fundamental virtue in spiritual life. It's the mental event that we most need in order to activate our aspiration and inspiration. And we need to be working all the time at our strong tendencies to laziness, just indulging ourselves in unskillful things, letting ourselves off by assuming that we can't do it. So then we move on to another pairing. And this is upeksha and sthana. So I want to look first at sthana, because that illustrates more clearly what upeksha is. Sthana is tina in Pali. It's in the Nivarana. Sorry?
Isn't it
prasabdhi? Oh, sorry, yes. Thank you. Prashrabdhi and sthana. We're dealing with prashrabdhi, and sthana is its counterpart. And sthana is, in Pali, tina, as in tina midha, sloth and torpor. So sthana is sloth. But it's really a kind of mental stagnation, even depression. It's got three primary aspects to it. First of all, that there's a sort of feeling of weight, of heaviness, dullness. You literally feel physically heavy. It's difficult to move yourself.
difficult to move your limbs at its worst. That's what you feel like, as if you've got no physical energy, let alone mental energy. So there's this dullness of and weightiness, weighed downness. Secondly, it's a sort of a lack of movement of energy. It's a stagnation, inertia of energy. Your energy doesn't flow, so it's just stuck, it's just stiff, rigid, unable to respond. Well, and that is the third aspect of sthana. It is this incompetence of the mind, this lack of pliancy of the mind. It's unable to really respond to what faces it. It can't grasp things because it's so stiff and rigid. And it leads to inadequate comprehension. You don't see things properly. You don't clarify what's in front of you. You do not clarify your mind. So even just at the level of ordinary perception, you don't see things properly. You don't take them in properly. You don't sort of really clarify what they are and distinguish them fully. So it's a sort of inattentiveness. But it's also incompetent. The mind is very inefficient. It doesn't work very well. You don't think very clearly. You don't process information very well. In this case, it's not middha, which is of course motivated by real tiredness or illness. It's a mental state. It's a mental condition that one has fallen into. A dullness of body and mind, which comes about from quite a number of different causes. I think at least one cause of it is prolonged lack of exercise. If one does not, move oneself around, if one doesn't exercise oneself, well, gradually the whole system starts to close down. I did read somewhere recently that some studies had shown that the most effective treatment for depression was exercise, going for a run every day. And some control experiments have been done on this recently. I don't know how far-reaching and exhaustive they were, but it's certainly an ordinary observation that very often when people get into this sort of dead and dull and stuck state, they just need to get their bodies moving. They need to do some work. So lack of exercise is often the cause of this dullness. Bhante said that often monks in the East suffer from this sort of sthana because they have no real physical outlets and they're not supposed to work. So they just become very dull. Also, eat too much. It's another cause of it. It can also be the consequence of deep conflict. So that your energies are so sort of locked in conflict that no energy flows. It's the sort of thing where you're trying to do something and you just cannot get any vigour going. You can't get any energy flowing. And your feeling is, if you really analyse it, that you don't want to be doing what you're doing. It's often not quite as simple as that when you look at it. It's not so much that you don't want to be doing it, but that you have other things you want that you're not resolving. Of course, sometimes you don't want to do it, and you sort of feel you're forced to do it, and that will also lead to sthana. It's quite dangerous to let oneself get into this state because it's self-replicating and digs a deeper and deeper ditch for itself. The more you're in that state, the less you feel like doing anything. The less you feel like doing anything, the less you do, the more you feel like not doing anything, and so forth. So that's sthana, a pretty horrible state, very painful. It's opposed by prashrabdi, which is really exactly the opposite of sthana. It's very difficult to translate prashrabdi. It's often translated as something like tranquility or serenity. But again, it's got three characteristics. First of all, it's a great feeling of lightness and ease. And you literally feel as if your body is floating when you're in this state to a very high degree, as in the third dhyana, which is characterized by prashrabdi, by the dying away of Priti and the arising of Prashrabdi. So your body just feels extremely light, and you feel very much at ease. Your mind is very free and open. So it's a very relaxed state. It's said that you feel as if you're just thistle down blowing on the wind. You've got no sort of weight, no gravity. Secondly, it's a state of great calmness, composure and serenity. And in this sense, it's very much identified with the third dhyana, where all the release of energy of the previous dhyanas has ended. Priti is the release of deep energies, which in the third dhyana are fully absorbed. So Prashrabdi is a state of the complete absorption of all the energies of the mind. And so you feel very, very much at ease. There's no agitation, no shaking. And then thirdly, it's a state of great suppleness, flexibility and pliancy. Your mind is ready. It can move in whatever direction you want it to move. It can apply itself to whatever you need to apply it to. And this, of course, is essential for the arising of insight. You need a ready mind, in the sense, a mind that's not fixed or rigid, that's not hardened and unwilling to accept new things, and especially accept the final truth of things. You need a mind that's very, very flexible and free and light and plastic, pliable. So Prashrabdi, in this sense, is a very, very important precursor to insight. The capacity to absorb the truth, you could say, Prashrabdi is. So Prashrabdi is considered to be only experienced fully in dhyana, especially in the third dhyana. But I think that you can still see a sort of continuum from dhyana to Prashrabdi, and recognize yourself as oscillating or varying within that continuum. Sometimes you do feel your energies are very dull, very fixed, very rigid. Sometimes you feel they're much freer and more pliable. And, well, obviously one needs to be trying to move one's energies more and more in the direction of Prashrabdi, which is especially experienced through meditation. So that's the pairing of Prashrabdi and dhyana. So now we move on to the final, grouping. There are two upaklesas, audacha and vikshepa, which oppose upeksha. So let's look at the upaklesas first, because that gives us a pretty good idea of what the Kushala Chaita Dharma is. Audacha is again recognizable, should be recognizable to you from the nivaranas, the hindrances. It's udacha in Pali, which is part of that set udacha kakucha, the bossa nova one. So udacha kakucha is restlessness and anxiety. That's what it's usually translated as, but we've been seeing that kakucha is really properly remorse. So audacha is restlessness, and it definitely is an upaklesha, whereas kukucha, you remember, is a variable mental state. So audacha is turbulence, excitability. The mind is disturbed and agitated in relation to the object. You've got an object before you, and your mind is sort of unsteady in relation to it. You're constantly shifting your attitude and your position in relation to it. It's the mind that's unsteady. The object is relatively stable, but your mind is sort of constantly thinking different things about it. You can't settle your mind. And especially you can't settle it because your mind is sort of urgently looking for some pleasurable aspects or associations of what is in front of you. Audacha is primarily motivated by a quest for pleasure. It's primarily a manifestation of craving. And to that extent, I think audacha is more difficult to recognize than vikshepa, which is distraction, because it's tinged with pleasure. My own feeling is it's much easier to recognize hatred than craving, because hatred is unpleasant in itself.
Whereas craving, you've got the idea of a pleasure that you're going to have, so you think of craving as pleasurable, even though actually it's a state of longing, therefore of deprivation. So audacia can often be a very sort of, well, you can like being in that state. You feel very sort of lively and excited and enthused in the sense of excited. Your mind is sort of jumping around with eagerness, looking at it from this angle, looking at it from that angle, seeing this possibility, seeing that possibility. I think pride also plays its part, because you're just sort of intoxicated with the exuberance of your own cleverness. You just think, you know, here am I producing all these wonderful ideas. This is all aspects of audacia. I know this one fairly well. Your mind is unsteady, because it's sort of intoxicatedly looking for some pleasurable aspects of what you're engaged with. It's trying to get itself some pleasure. It's of course implicit in all klesha-filled minds to some extent. If your mind is full of klesha, it's turbulent, it's disturbed, it's constantly sort of moving around, trying to find a pleasurable angle on what you're attending to. And it's quite good to identify this sort of mental turbulence more directly, to see the way in which your mind is sort of quivering and unsteady. Because that's a primary sign that you need to develop upeksha. And as I say, often it can be rather pleasurable in its immediate experience, or you associate it with pleasure. Vikshepa is not so much to do with the unsteadiness of the mind, it's the unsteadiness of the object. So it's distraction. Vikshepa is the scattering of the mind to other objects. It's wandering, it's drifting. It's just sort of drifting from this to that in a very light way. With audacia, it's the way you relate to the object that is agitated and changing. With vikshepa, it's the actual object that changes. So we take hold of an object with manaskara. You remember that sequence that we dealt with in the second day, the sequence of the Sarvatrigga Chaitadharmas. You cognize an object, and for an instant, so to speak, you hold it in your mind. You pay attention to it. That is manaskara. Naturally, if we continue to pay attention to the object, smriti and then samadhi arise. Smriti being continued recollection of the object, samadhi being absorption in the object. But vikshepa scatters the mind away from the object of attention, so that you lose that attention. The interesting thing is, it's not just a word for what happens. It's a function, so to speak. It's a function of the mind. All the Chaitadharmas are actual forces in the mind. So it's a force in the mind that scatters the mind. It's as if there's some sort of energy that moves the mind off the object that's in front of it. So you get into a sort of vikshepa-filled mental state, and your mind just moves from object to object. So we need both to steady the mind in its attention to the object, but we also need to steady the object. And it's the steadying in both these senses that is upeksha, equanimity, it's usually translated. Before we look at upeksha a bit more closely, we need to clarify some terminology here. Because we find upeksha used in a number of different ways in the tradition. For instance, upeksha is used in the simple sense of neutral vedana. Remember, we have sukha and dukkha, and between the two is a very low state of hedonic preference, so to speak, which is upeksha. It's neutral feeling, which has no moral implications at all. Even it may have psychological ones, because upeksha may result from a mere dulling of sensitivity, but that's another question. Then secondly, we have upeksha used as a dhyana factor. When you're in the fourth dhyana, you remember
Preeti has died away in the third dhyana, and Sukha has died away in the fourth dhyana, what you're left with is upeksha, which isn't, of course, an unpleasant or neutral state. It's a state that's so positive and so pleasant, if you can use that term, that it can't even be described as happiness. It's something happier than happiness, if you like. It's got no sort of excitement to it. It's just an absolutely calm, steady, a deeply positive state. Thirdly, there's upeksha in the sense of the fourth Brahma-vihara, that is the complete equalization of one's positive feelings towards all beings. So you feel maitri towards all, karuna to those who suffer, and mudita to those who are successful and in positive condition. And Bhante equates the fourth Brahma-vihara with a transcendental state. He considers that when you've developed upeksha properly, you are effectively transcending the subject-object distinction. So he sees this third kind of upeksha as equivalent to nirvana. So he analyzes the seventh bodhyanga, which is upeksha, as the goal of spiritual life. So we've got these three usages of upeksha. As neutral feeling, the dhyana factor distinctive to the fourth dhyana, and as the fourth Brahma-vihara, which is in its highest dimension transcendental. Here we're dealing primarily with the second of these usages. We're dealing with the sense of upeksha as a dhyana factor, although in a sense we're expanding that notion. It's not just as a dhyana factor, but the dhyana factor is that aspect of upeksha apotheosized, taken to its highest degree. So upeksha is a combination, it's virya combined with alobha, advesha and amoha. There's a definite opposition to the basic unskillful mental states of craving, hatred and delusion. You have those positive states of non-delusion, non-hatred, non-craving, and that's combined with virya, so a strong effort to realize and sort of soak oneself in, abide in those positive states. So this means that the mind is completely free from the kleshas. The kleshas can't get a grip on your mind. You're just completely absorbed in a concentrated and happy and uplifted state with no tendency towards the unskillful. Because virya is there, as it were, pushing you away from lobha, dvesha and moha. So you could say it's a state of non-reactivity. You don't react to anything in the world. You don't find yourself, when somebody insults you or whatever, you don't find yourself bothered. When something arises that might be an object of craving, you're not attracted. And you don't fall into false views. You're just not interested. So it's a state of absorption in this higher calmness, equanimity, even-mindedness. It's especially talked of in terms of balance. You're not sort of driven in one direction or the other. There are three levels of upeksha. First of all, there's the balanced mind upeksha, the equanimity of the balanced mind. Here, you have achieved this balance, but there's quite a bit of effort involved. It's the sort of thing that you can get into in meditation. You can be in an equanimous state, quite balanced and absorbed, but you have to constantly make an effort because your mind naturally tends to sort of spill out into turbulence, into adaccha or vikshepa. But with effort, and quite a bit of effort, you can maintain that balance. The second level is the level of the mind at rest, upeksha, which is the mind at rest. So the mind has begun to steady itself in this deep state of calmness and equanimity and balance. And there's no great effort
in remaining in that serene state. Yes, you just have to make a little bit of sort of adjustment every now and again as habits start to take hold or as external factors begin to impinge. You just have to sort of push them away, put them on one side. Finally, there's the upeksha that consists in the spontaneous mind, where you don't have to make any effort at all. You're completely absorbed in that equanimous state. Your mind is entirely balanced, completely naturally and spontaneously. You don't have to make any effort. You're just not interested in anything unskillful. Nothing can touch you. Nothing can move you. You sometimes get some sense of this when you come off an intensive retreat. I remember a very, very vivid experience of this these levels coming off a solitary retreat I'd done in Greece. I spent 3 months on my own. And I remember coming into Athens afterwards. And to begin with, so I walked into Athens, which is an extremely noisy and polluted city, and very crowded and even aggressive. I felt as if it just sort of wasn't touching me, as if I was surrounded by a force field which Athens just couldn't get through. But gradually I saw that wearing away, and just after, I'm ashamed to admit, 3 months of effort took about an hour to wear away. I started to be pulled here and there by the forces of Athens. But it was a very tangible experience of a degree of equanimity, at least. I certainly don't want to claim too high. But I think probably one can experience something in that direction, a certain balance and calmness and poisedness, which is then lost if we don't have the right conditions. Well, that is obviously balanced mind. Mind at rest is where, well, we just have to make a little mental effort. We're not just subject to conditions. We've got the fortitude and the awareness to keep on adjusting in ourselves. And finally, the spontaneous mind. We don't even have to make an effort. Nothing can touch us. State of mind, much to be desired. So, we need to develop upeksha as a counter to audacia and vikshepa. And when we find ourselves experiencing vikshepa, distraction of mind, well, it's helpful to think in terms of actively developing upeksha. We've got some feeling, I hope, for that very balanced, pliable state of mind, and we can make an effort to absorb ourselves in it and to recognise that vikshepa is not a sort of natural or inevitable way of functioning. Similarly, we can face up to the excitability and changeability and turbulence of audacia, even if we think of it as a rather an exciting and pleasant state. We can face up to it and recognise that if we are in a state of audacia, we can very, very easily and quickly react. And, we try to seek that state of even-mindedness, of non-reactivity, natural non-reactivity, not a sort of stoic endurance, although that may be the beginnings of genuine upeksha. I think the Stoics recognised this, that to begin with, a training and discipline is necessary, but eventually it becomes something quite spontaneous. So each of these pairs or groupings is very much a part of our experience. There's a continuum from laziness to genuine spiritual effort, which we all of us experience ourselves oscillating within. There's a continuum from heaviness and dullness of energies to a lightness and pliancy, adaptability, readiness of mind. And again, we all of us experience ourselves oscillating within that. And there's an oscillation from an unsteadiness of mind, whether it's in terms of unsteadiness of the mind in relation to the object or of the object in relation to the mind. And that is gradually transcended in upeksha, where we are able to just absorb ourselves in a balanced, a steady, deeply happy and calm, serene mental state. Of course, virya is the most immediately significant, because it's virya that enables us to develop prashabdi and upeksha. And probably for most of us, this is where we need to
make more effort. We need to make more effort with effort. We need to be especially conscious of what effort means in our own experience. We need to detect effort and see also, perhaps more importantly, non-effort. We have to see koshidya, laziness. I think that if we were able to identify laziness in all its forms much more quickly, well, it would be much easier to develop virya. Part of the problem with laziness is that it can be very seductive. We can persuade ourselves that we ought to be lazy. Of course, we don't call it that, but we need to explore our baser energies, or we feel we need to be more normal or ordinary, or we've got all sorts of ways of thinking about it. Or, well, you know, spiritual life is for particular people, special people, not for me, with all my disadvantages. We've got all sorts of ways, or I need a bit more sleep. Sometimes you do, but sometimes you don't. So in various ways, we justify laziness without even realising that's what we're doing. So I think this is one of the most helpful teachings in this whole set, to me at any rate, just to identify what laziness is, so that as soon as we're experiencing it, well, we can exercise virya. Or at least if we're not exercising virya, to know that we're not. And that, in its turn, should hopefully arouse kokrucha, which will get us going. Well, in a way, that's true, isn't it? Because if you identify laziness as laziness, well, then you will feel ashamed. And then you will feel the painful aspects, well, the painful consciousness of letting yourself down, and that will get you to move. So there we are. That's our little clutch for today. Tomorrow we're dealing with two batches. We've got apramada, which I've got to try by tomorrow to work out exactly what it is. But I'll have a go at a non-heedlessness. I think that's what I said the other day, but I'm told I didn't. And non-heedlessness, apramada, is opposed by the upaklesha of pramada, which is heedlessness. And also by asamprajanya, lack of clear understanding, lack of clear comprehension, even lack of purpose, and mushita smrutita, which is lack of smruti, or lack of basic mindfulness, basic recollection. So we'll be dealing with a complex which is to do with the various aspects of mindfulness, which I think is quite a useful tripartite distinction of the term that we use as mindfulness, the term mindfulness, which we commonly use. Then we'll be dealing with the pairing of avihingsa and vihingsa, non-cruelty and cruelty. And we'll see that that's probably quite a good note to end on.